Greetings to all you accursed. Hurley here on the rudder for your weekly hit of Curse of Politics. A note off the top, the pod's missing its left flank. We're down to Leibniz today. Jordan will be back next week, though. But Scott is back this week after a one-week sojourn. Scott, welcome back to the show. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to be seen.
Yeah. And Corey has promised to compensate for Jordan's absence by leaning into his sensitive socialist side. That's what spending a week in Paris eating baguettes will do for you. He's got that all nailed down. He's been in France so long, he's probably on strike.
You know it.
All right.
You know
it. Here's the show. We're going to start off in Ontario with what else? The AG's report on the Greenbelt. What are the implications of this? What are the tactics being employed by each of the parties in the wake of it? Our cursed clipping this week is from Alex Ballingall at The Star on Trudeau and the Liberal government's weak response to the housing crisis and what looked like a kinder, gentler Pierre Poilievre to most of us after the release of his new branding campaign went by the wayside pretty quickly with the demonization of the media and the World Economic Forum. Will that kind of stuff cap his numbers or won't it matter to people as he double-tracks messaging? After that, Gordon Pinsa tees up our Hey Yous. All right, guys. Corey, tell us about Paris. How's it going? France. Where the hell are you?
It's great. I'm just outside of Fontainebleau, the summer home and hunting grounds of many a French king. And it's spectacular. Fine wine, runny cheese, all the good stuff. It's a real populist for the people. Sort
are you
of
just going to drop that, like that Fontainebleau thing? Like we're supposed to know what it is? Was I supposed to learn about that in grade 11 or something? Like,
well,
I don't know what that is.
You probably did, but you've forgotten. You know, I think Pope was held here captive for a while. You know, I think it was early seat of power for Louis XIV. You know, the only king that matters. I think probably for most people who are studying French politics, but. It's spectacular. I'm actually at Nicole's family's place. She has an aunt and uncle who live here, so I'm sitting on their deck and joining you on a very sunny, beautiful afternoon.
It's beautiful.
Nicole's family is French royalty.
No, they're not.
You have like portraits, beheaded portraits up on the wall.
If only I were so lucky. She has an aunt and uncle who've been here, I don't know, 30 years, maybe more, but via Quebec, via Ontario, via Alberta, many other places.
Scott, you must like that holding the Pope hostage thing. You hate Catholics.
Yeah, I wouldn't say hate. Hate's a strong word, but, you know, they certainly make me uncomfortable. I don't know. A bunch of the things they say make me feel frustrated. By the way,
ever since the Fenian raids, you just really haven't gotten over any of those papists and Irish and everything else, I'm sure, right?
You can take the boy out of the Masonic Lodge, but you can't take the Masonic Lodge out of the boy. That's what we say in Prince Edward Hastings.
Probably the only place where you can still get a good Orangeman's parade. Fair enough.
All right, let's get going. So, AG's reports, fuck what I'm a government, I hate these things. I've had some bad experiences with them. Big one last week in Ontario, though, where the Auditor General really was highly critical of the process that had been employed to put Greenbelt lands up for development. Expressly stated that there was favoritism involved and that the process was untransparent and cronyistic. So, big news. It made big, big news. Years ago, I did a survey for the Jimmy Pattison School of Ethics at what was then Ryerson University on scandals. And it was in the middle of the Rob Ford era in Toronto. And I actually described different types of scandals that had occurred in Canadian history. And asked people how serious they thought they were and what the penalties politically ought to have been for those scandals. And the thing that was interesting emerged was that people really drew a clear line, it seemed, in the way they reacted from scandals in which there was individual financial gain and from scandals in which there was not individual financial gain. which explained, for example, why the sponsorship issue was a much, much bigger issue for people than, say, gas plants in Ontario were, or Rob Ford's substance abuse issues. Because while those were scandalous in their own way, they don't offend people in the same way as money changing hands does. So I think that that's sort of interesting in this context. The current government, I just think the current government line that this is a rogue staffer doesn't stand up to scrutiny or credibility. So I don't know where that's all going to go. But Scott, when the AG in 2003 released her report on the sponsorship program, the bottom fell out of Liberal support. People reacted so virulently to that that there was an immediate reaction in public opinion polling, significant and material. Do you think that will happen here?
Yeah, I think there'll be a dent. I don't think it'll be a giant hole. And I think that, you know, there's a bunch of things that help. It's kind of a complicated story. When people start talking about zoning and all of that, I don't think that the opposition parties have done an effective job in turning this into something that should hurt more. I can talk more about that. I think on the tactics side that the government has actually been reasonably effective in its approach to rebut it. I think its issues management strategy is interesting. I suspect for other reasons, possibly doomed to fail, but I think that in the near term, it's been very interesting. But I think the challenge for the Ford government is what's to come. Like, I think we're at the beginning of something, not at the end of something. I don't think the Auditor General is saying, okay, well, let's get through the first few days and then it's on the other side of it. I mean, fuck only knows what this sleepy old judge who's never seen anything he didn't approve, who is the Integrity Commissioner in Ontario, will conclude. But I suspect, to your point about money changing hands, you know, if he comes to the conclusion, particularly with his mandate, that there were people making middleman money off of this, you know, I assume, just as a out of the gate, I assume that the enormous value unlocked for two developers doesn't mean that somebody's on the taking government. And maybe I'm naive for that, but I just operate on the assumption that, like, outright explicit government elected their senior staff, like, that kind of level of corruption is just so rare. And I work on the assumption until it's proven otherwise that that's not what's going on. But I think there were others involved in and around this process that made money. I think that the phrase unregistered lobbying is going to become a big fucking problem for the government down the road on this file. So I think we're in the early chapters, not the middle or closing chapters. And I think and all that may be wrong. Like, those assumptions I have may be wrong. The ethics, this integrity commissioner may say, talk to some people. They all told me that they just had dinner and that it's cool. And, you know, so on, so by. But if I'm right, and if the phrase unregistered lobbying becomes a headache, if there are people that were charging success fees while they were unregistered lobbying, if those people have an established history with Doug Ford, then I think this stuff starts to sink in. And what happens, of course, is cronyism and corruption. Those phrases start to swirl around the government. And, like, it's not impossible to win, even because we live in such a cynical age. But once that stuff starts to settle in and people think that's the actual definition of the character of your government, then that's a problem. They're not there yet. So I think this got noticed. I think that people are cynical. I think that people's low expectations of politics were reinforced by what they saw this week. But I don't think this thing is sponsorship. I don't think it's hit that level. I do think it has the potential to be extremely damaging in terms of the character definition of this government if other shoes start to fall. And I think other shoes will fall. That's my bet. I should say, I do not have any truck or trade with this Auditor General. I assume that this work is thorough, but I think she's unprofessional. I don't really think she had any business doing this study. I'm glad she did, certainly from a partisan perspective. I think that, you know, reasonable work was done. But I just want to add that proviso, because I don't want to sound like a raving partisan. Like, I've never been a fan of her. I don't think she's professional. But I don't think you can dismiss her work in this instance either.
Corey, how big a deal is this?
Well, it depends. Like, I think it, largely on many of the things that Scott already mentioned, but I think it depends on one other set of things that that he didn't talk about, and it's clearly where the government is putting the weight of its communications response, which is around the problem of housing overall. And we're going to talk about that, you know, later with respect to the federal government. Outcomes matter. In terms of this issue, the housing issue, I think, is the largest and most politically potent issue on the political landscape today, federally, provincially, municipally. We are in a full-on housing crisis, and it's a crisis that's getting worse with every passing day. We are having record levels of immigration. We are having, combined with that, and in response to that, record skill shortages, in particularly in construction trades, for building things such as housing. You know, what we have is, the other element, which we've talked about before, is millennials who are starting to have kids and looking to buy housing that is larger and more similar to what they grew up with and experienced when they were kids, and wanting that for their children. And so trying to have a little bit more space, you know, being in your one or two bedroom piece of paradise in the sky in downtown Toronto is great until you until you're having your second kid. And at that point, you're about ready to throw yourself off the balcony. So, you know, you have new Canadians, you have millennials in competition for basically no new housing. You know, we're letting in, and last year I think it was 500,000 people into the province of Ontario, most of them in the GTA. More immigration, more population growth than Florida and Texas combined, the two fastest growing states in the United States. This is a five-alarm fire. And we have a housing deficit of probably a couple million homes. And, you know, if you wanted to take all that pressure off the system, and, you know, the aggressive plan of the provincial government is 1.5 million homes over 10 years. So it shows you even the most aggressive stance in terms of housing builds and housing starts is probably wholly inadequate to the size of the problem. So I think it's smart for the Ford government. And of course, I would say that I'm, you know, pretty heavily invested personally and professionally in the outcomes for that government. But I think it's smart for them to be taking on the mantle of being the problem solver in this area and talking about it in that context and advertising around it in that context. I think that's actually, at the end of the day, what matters most to folks is that. I agree with Scott. I don't think anybody made, you know, anyone in elected office or in you know, sort of central power structures of this government had anything to gain from doing this. And I don't think that there's anything inherently corrupt around the development industry. It's quite small in Ontario and in Canada. You know, you're talking about less than a half dozen firms that do most of the development in the province. And what's true about them? They give money to every government that's in power disproportionately, and have for as long as I've been involved in Ontario politics, which is, you know, pushing 30 years now. So I don't think there's anything unique about any of that. I don't think that the amounts of money involved in fundraising around this stuff are that meaningful. Ever since we got rid of corporate donations and union donations, the biggest developer in Ontario has the same cap as you and I and anyone else in terms of the size of the donation that they can give. So, you know, I think in terms of that element of it, it's, you know, it's not that meaningful. I think in terms of the, you know, transparency around decision making, I think there's some lessons to be learned there, and I think there's some bite that can that can gnaw at the government over time around those issues. But you know, at the end of the day, what's this all about? It's about building houses and trying to respond to a crisis in which, you know, we basically build nothing anywhere, or nothing adequate in terms of the numbers that we need to, or on the timelines that are required. And somebody has to bite the bullet on this. And we're going to talk about this shortly and with respect to the federal government as well. You know, we got to get our arms around this.
There is no innovation without its very close, shared first syllable cousin, investment. Investment of gray matter, time, money, blood, sweat, tears, and any other resource that's required to make a new thing a reality. And then to do it all over again and innovate afresh. That calculus has always been a driving force behind our presenting sponsor, TELUS. In fact, it drives their social purpose. They have a long history of innovating products, innovating entire business units, innovating social programs, and investing behind them to do good for people. Because, to tell us, that's good business. Well, here's another one, Hurley Burleyites. A little earlier this year, TELUS launched Canada's first 5G subscription phone service offered by their flanker brand, Public Mobile. Canadians want choice. They want the flexibility to adjust their phone service on their terms without the weight of a long-term contract. TELUS knows that. You know what else Canadians want? The power and speed of 5G. Reliable 5G. Public Mobile gives them all of that in our largest urban centers and in more remote parts of the country because it all rides on the award-winning TELUS network. It's 5G capability that's as simple and straightforward as it gets. Just choose the features and speed that work best for you and pay only for those on a recurring monthly subscription plan. And the whole thing can be stopped or changed at any time with no restrictions, just like any other subscription in your life. Plus, it's all digital first on the new Public Mobile app. Activate your subscription, make changes, get support, and earn rewards without any lineups or waiting on the phone, subjecting your ears and your soul to something that bears only a slight resemblance to music. Learn more about it at publicmobile.ca. So, Scott, that was a masterclass by Corey of the government's communication strategy on this.
Yes.
Right? Which is to not address the issue at all. They feel no need to address the allegations. They dismiss the allegations, essentially, acknowledge that there may be some small wrongdoing and talk about housing and the need for housing. And is that going to work?
Policy trumps process. So concede that there may have been vaguely ill-defined issues surrounding process. I'm not going to get into any of that. Let's let these processes unfold. In fact, we've accepted 14 of 15 of the Auditor General's recommendations. Indeed, we've invited the Integrity Commissioner, who no one's ever seen in daylight. As far as we know, he's a rabbit who's afraid of light to investigate this matter. So obviously, we are willing to acknowledge there may have been issues with process and we'll suffer the consequences of any challenges there. So diminish it as a process. But the broader policy issue is that we got to build, folks. We got to build, and that's what it's going to, and this is what it takes to build. So it's an ends justifies the means argument. And so let's get into the communications tactics, because I'm not going to, I think it stinks like the unpasteurized cheese that our friend Corey is getting to enjoy in giant quantities. And I'm very jealous of that. I think this thing is fucking rotten. Rotten. But let's go to the
based
comms.
Based on what? Based on like a vague partisan interest or a...
I'll tell you what it is. I don't want to get into a policy debate about it, but I believe that they created... what was created here was a system in spite of... it was detailed in the Auditor General's report, but it's a system where it puts developers at both ends of the tube. And it says, what would you like to have come in? And then you alone have unique opportunity to benefit from this. So you can uniquely contribute to the point where your recommendations will be cut and pasted into the recommendations that will go into the civil service that then generate the process. And then you alone can benefit from the result of that. So you get to design the tube. Well, you get to be at the other end of the tube. But okay, Corey,
that's not exactly accurate or truthful, right?
Is.
So no, it isn't. Because what actually occurred is... about 1% of the land involved in the Green Belt is what we're talking about. So, like, inconsequential.
Again, that's not a rebuttal.
Land.
Now you're back very skillfully deflecting and diminishing.
Let me finish.
Just 1%.
Let me finish. And if the people who are who own the land that is going to be developed here do not develop it within in a very aggressive timeline, then it goes back into the Green Belt. You're creating a foot race to actually get shit built, which is exactly what I think every level of government needs to be doing. You know,
and into Mexico, then we will take it back.
Well, but what is the actual issue that we're having? Is it that The people who want to develop homes aren't don't own land in which you can, or is it that many of them decide it's better not to develop and to just sit on it? And many municipalities, for their own reasons, NIMBYism, all kinds of other things, won't permit. You're creating a foot race to actually have housing built. You know, okay. That's exactly what we need to do. Every level of government.
That's not how an argument is. So here's my perspective. I want to talk about the comms on it, and inevitably we'll drive through some of these issues. So I think the government's response is very interesting, and if you look at it both in terms of strategy and execution. So the strategy, if you look at you within 2 hours of the Auditor General's report, the Premier and the Housing Minister have a news conference. So they did. What that tells you is they've made a determination that this issue is unavoidable, that this isn't sometimes, I mean, one of the most important strategic decisions you make when you're trying to issue a crisis, manage a crisis is, do we have to starve? Do we try to starve this thing of oxygen and attention? Or is it impossible to starve this thing of oxygen and attention? And therefore, we must be present and have a rebuttal that's persuasive to people. So they've made a decision they have to be present. So the Premier and the Housing Minister are there. They do all the things we've seen Corey do right now. The fundamental issue is really, it's about 1% of the land. That's no big deal. It's actually, you know, this is just process challenges. And by the way, housing, we got to get it built. And if you don't, if you are upset about this, then fundamentally you're on the wrong side of the big important issue, which is at the end of the day, what all that really matters. So you see that message being pounded out. It's reinforced through advertising, which I thought was smart. And my perception is the advertising, the paid media play was as much to keep conservatives strapped to the deck, to make certain that they saw the message because it'll hit their feeds in particular, and to make certain that don't lose nerve because of their neighbors talking and this thing bubbling up and for fear that it might, you know, take off as a skyrocket of the C word, corruption. So I thought that was smart. And then they had a daily newser afterwards. We're gonna do this. We're gonna announce that we're actually bracing the process questions. So we're gonna take one of the recommendations from the Auditor General and do that. Next day we're gonna have another one that moves us again back to the fundamental housing issue. We're gonna talk about housing. So I thought all those tactics made sense. I think that will help them through this initial period of challenge. I thought they made the right judgment strategically that they couldn't avoid talking about it.
Can I follow up with this and ask you a question?
Yeah.
I think it's possible that when all the dust settles on this thing, people will draw whatever conclusions they will have drawn about the process and who benefited from it. But it feels like the government will have had an opportunity to convince people that it really fucking cares about housing.
And it's more about housing than others.
Correct.
I think that's
right.
All right. So, I think that's really important. Hang on. I just want to finish, Corey. I swear to God.
All right. You finish. All right.
Let me finish. Because I want to add this. By contrast, I look at the scattergun approach of the two opposition parties, and they've been all over it. One of the principal tactics of the NDP, as an example, has been to take, if you look at their social media feeds, take excerpts of the Auditor General's report, things that are difficult for people to see, they probably missed, things that are extraordinarily, genuinely, extraordinarily damning about the process. And certainly anybody who's worked in government looks at it and just goes, that is no good, man. That is rotted fish territory. And they put that out there. I think it's ineffective. To me, I think I go back to your paper that you talked about, David, right? There are two words that the opposition should be saying, should have said on day one, should have said loudly, should have taken out advertising and should continue to say. And those two words are 8 billion. I would say 8 billion, 8 billion, 8 billion. Government designed a process enabled by the developers so that those same developers could realize $8 billion worth of value. I would pound away. The Auditor General's giving you that figure. It is a fucking golden stocking stuffer, and I would wave it around over and over and over again. One of the greatest pieces of political branding I've seen in the last 30 years was when the Reform conservatives, when they pounded away and they branded all that stuff on the on the grants and gifts program way back in the day in the 1990s when they billion dollar boondoggle caught people's imagination. It told people it was about money. It took it from a regular process bullshit politics thing that I don't like, and maybe something bad happened, into money, into I must be getting fucked. My something's going on. So I would hammer on this $8 billion and I would let the conservatives come back and go, hang on. It's not public money. I see that rebuttal. I say that's a losing argument. Get the conservatives sucked into talking about it's not public money. And then you're off.
Can you remind me, though? Can you remind me, was it two or three times more that the liberals were elected after billion-dollar boondoggle? Hey. I think it was two. I might be wrong. It might have been three.
It was vital, though. Because after that, Kretchen's armor was dented. And then by the time the arrows got through.
Yeah. Well, I remember an ad that
Corey, you lit up when I mentioned the fact that the government may actually be able to judo this into a dominant positioning on housing.
Well, Scott is portraying the government's response as being not welcoming this conversation, whereas I would put to you that the government very much welcomes this conversation, and that what the opposition are going to be unavoidably backed into doing. And I think if the federal government isn't careful, they'll end up in this position too, as being the people lined up next to everyone who says, don't build anything anywhere. Don't deal with this crisis. Fuck all of that. No. No to development, no to housing, no to more housing being built. And standing with those folks and parroting their lines and, you know, having them run as candidates for them. And what will be absolutely conclusive at the end of that process is there is only one party and only one government that is actually focused on building more housing and willing to actually take on vested interests in order to do it. And I think that's what these guys are lining up to do. And I think,
okay, but if that's the case,
the government's response is that, like, let's have this conversation. Let's welcome the controversy and have the conversation.
To appreciate how important Canada's grain crop is to the world, consider this. The black soil belt that stretches across Ukraine and much of Eastern Europe, one of the world's greatest agri-food regions, is a war zone. Russia has not only abandoned its commitment to allow safe passage of Ukrainian grain, it is now attacking grain storage facilities, attempting to destroy precious reserves of food. All of that makes Canadian grain even more crucial to global markets. And the job of shipping it smoothly and competently falls to railways like our sponsor CN. That job is such a national priority that CN is required by law to file an annual grain plan to the federal government, assessing whether it has the capacity to handle expected crop yields. In plain language, the answer this year is yes. CN has more than enough resources to do the job. CN puts a great deal of revenue back into its trains, tracks, and technology, so its fleet of locomotives and hopper cars is newer and faster than ever. And its laser focus on ensuring trains depart and arrive on time has paid off. Last year, the average velocity of CN trains, the number of miles a railway car travels in a given day, was the best in years. So yes, a qualified yes, because so much is out of the railway's hands. There's a new federal regulation in place that obliges railways to deliver cargo to competitors, sometimes several times between origin and destination, at the whim of multinational grain corporations. That will soak up time and money. And it remains next to impossible to load grain at the Port of Vancouver's terminals when it's raining. And in Vancouver, you know, rain. Grain companies, not the railways, operate those terminals. Several days of rainfall can jam up the entire system, causing severe backups and delays. CN trains sit idle, unable to unload, unable to return for new shipments. Meanwhile, ports in eastern Canada, which have no such issues, are underutilized by multinational grain shippers. And of course, as we are seeing, weather is becoming ever more extreme and unpredictable. CN is absolutely committed to moving Canada's grain to market on schedule. But increasingly, the only way to guarantee that is tight, determined, relentless collaboration and transparency among all the players in the grain supply chain. Farmers, grain companies, truckers, railways, ports, and maritime vessels, to name a few. CN respectfully submits requiring that kind of collaboration and transparency is an appropriate role for government. Well, if that's the case, Corey, why isn't the government owning the process? Why is it trying to blame this staffer? Because there's just no chance in the world this guy did this on his own. And I, in my experience, people don't like it when the politicians try to evade accountability like this.
Well, how is the government doing that? The government has welcomed an ethics investigation into this individual. They don't believe that there's anything bad that's going on around him. But they're welcoming an investigation and a process into that. I don't think that's where any of this is going. Where I think this is and continues to be is, there are a lot of different interests that are lined up against building new housing, and you see it all the time. You see it in places that you wouldn't expect, like the corner.
Are those interests in the government bureaucracy? Because one of the interesting things about this is that the bureaucracy was cut out of this process.
Some of them are in the government bureaucracy. Absolutely, they are. And they're in government bureaucracies at many different levels, who are often captive to stakeholders within their own environment. So, when you're in an environment portfolio and you're working in that ministry, often you're held captive to environmental stakeholders. When you're in the energy ministry, you're often held captive by energy industry stakeholders. Like, this is not news to you or I or anyone who's ever worked in government. But at the end of the day, it takes agreement often between three different levels of government in order to get anything built in this country, whether it's a new freeway overpass, whether it's any of these things. This is why we have such an infrastructure, including housing, deficit. We're building the Ontario line right now that should have been built in 1980. And why hasn't it been? It's certainly not because, city planners and others didn't see the need. If you're going to have half million more people living along the lakeshore, that you shouldn't have a subway line that runs along there. We haven't built another yard of sidewalk, let alone more mass transit for all those people that we invited to live there. And as anyone who's lived in the GTA can tell you, it's absolutely fucking impossible to get from A to B most times of the day in most parts of the city. And, this is a failure of three levels of government, and where the votes are is in taking that on. Now, I'll finish on this. The politics on this are complicated, and you can look to BC to see how it's complicated. People who are, current homeowners in large parts of the GTA, basically people who are, my parents' age, others, who, might be in their 70s, they own a home. And they are big net winners of, having bought a property in the, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, whenever it was, but they've seen massive appreciation and growth in the value of that property that they own. And, what are they worried about? They're worried about a condo tower blocking out their view of the CN Tower. They're worried about all kinds of things that are not actually
a little personal
more housing.
It's a little personal. It's a little on the nose.
David's yard used to be unshaded. Now it's a dense, dark place.
But you see the point. Like this is actually where this issue takes root. So, for instance, in Toronto, I love this one because I used to live in the neighborhood, Roncesvalles, the corner of Dundas and Bloor. Where there's a major, transit, it's a subway point. It's a major interpass for streetcars, et cetera, et cetera. There's huge opposition in the local community to building a condo tower at a major intersection on a major thoroughfare on a subway line. And, and the rationale is, there's 12 artists who live in the, the derelict building, at that corner. And, God, what will we do if those people are displaced and we build 250 units of housing or whatever the number is? It's like, it is that times so many other sites across the entire province. And, we have to fucking break a few eggs if we're going to make an omelet here. And we've got to, at all levels of government, get together and say no to some of the NIMBYism, say no to some of the people who are, establishment property owners who value, who've derived great value and benefit from having owned property and bought property when they did, and have some transfer of wealth here in terms of, building housing that is affordable, that is attainable for all of the people that we are bringing in to this province to pay for your fucking retirement and your healthcare. So for the baby boomers and others who are in that situation, I'd say if you want to have access to healthcare and other things which require a lot of taxpayers for every one retired person, we got to shift that ratio. We've got to bring in more people. We have got to have housing for those people. You need to have housing for your own children. We need to get over the NIMBYism and we need to build this shit. And it's that simple. And I think the winning politics on this over time is in favor of those who are going to build. And it's not, you know, one little project here or there that's, you know, for this aggrieved group or that aggrieved group at below market rates. That is not going to do anything to fix this. You need to build mass amounts of housing for all the people who, you know, don't have some special status of victimhood.
All right, fine French wines.
Regular people.
Fine French wines have done nothing to.
While Corey comes up for air,
fine French wines have done nothing to dull Corey. We started out, you know, talking about a biased, prejudiced process that put $8 billion into the hands of two families, and now we end up talking about cocksucking broken sidewalks. Anyway, I love you. I will just say this: I think you guys are on track. You're good. But I would just, in all honesty, my final word would be all of that argumentation, I think, will work to your benefit. There is a strong possibility that this thing ends up having a net effect of people going, maybe something happened, I don't know. But I now generally associate the Ford government more with trying to get stuff built than the others. And that probably is a net benefit. But except all of that can be completely redefined. You must fear the integrity commissioner and or if there are police investigations that generate something. Because if those things happen, if you end up with people with mugshots, this whole thing will be redefined. It will not be about housing policy. It'll be about corruption. It'll be about cronyism. And that stuff sticks. $8 billion. That's my advice to the opposition parties. I would wallpaper the province with $8 billion.
Well, if somebody did something wrong, they should be punished. Like, you know, I don't think anybody.
That's what we always say until punishing someone results in our ballots being burned.
Well, you know, let's see. It depends.
All right. It does depend. So we'll see. All right. We have a clipping today. Our clipping is adjacent to this topic. Our clipping is from Alex Ballingall on the Toronto Star. My God, we seem to cite Alex Ballingall pretty regularly on this show. Must be doing a good job out there. It's all, and he's writing about housing and the federal government's posture on housing. And I'll just, here's a segment from the article. It's all part of what Tyler Meredith, who was a senior economic advisor in Trudeau's office from 2020 to 2022, calls a toxic political dilemma for the Liberal government, and one it's not doing enough to address, he said. The government has got to come forward with some other ideas. Signaling a potential shift, Trudeau named Sean Fraser, a well-liked MP from Nova Scotia, as the new Minister of Housing and Infrastructure in his cabinet overhaul last month. In a recent interview with The Star, Fraser said he's looking at all policy options to speed up the construction of housing, but he also said there's no need to pledge new federal dollars, stating there are still billions in the government's 10-year housing plan that should be used first. For some, the position raised further questions about whether the Liberals are really serious about tackling Canada's persistent housing challenges. The federal government is the national leader of our country, and we have a national problem, said Jacob Gorenkoff, Director of Policy and Government Relations with the Canadian Housing and Renewal Association. We're well past time to get all hands on deck. This is one of the most perplexing things about the cabinet shuffle to me, because they obviously identified this as a pressing political issue. They moved somebody they thought was a very able political minister into this portfolio and then immediately signaled to Canadians that they should expect no change in the federal government's role in housing. Scott, what do you think?
I think it's a great piece, because I think he really puts his thumb on the problem. And I hope that the federal government, I hope the PMO has printed out copies of that article and placed it on everyone's desk. Because, you know, as I said after the cabinet shuffle, I sort of, you know, I made the argument directly to Sean Fraser that, one, don't let finance and PMO run this file. If you're going to be in this position, you gotta force the system to generate some creative solutions. Walking in and them saying, great news, minister, have a seat, grab a coffee. Here's what we're going to do with the infrastructure program. It's going to be rolled out the day before or the day after Minister Freeland's fiscal update, and it's going to be perfect. Fucking no. right? And I mean, all of the tools today have been an advertisement for what happens to you when you've been in government too long, right? The prime minister saying, listen, I just want to back into this most important issue for people by saying that it's not a federal responsibility. Notwithstanding that, we'll still sort of do something. But really, you know, if I say it's not our responsibility, then somehow we won't own it as much. I mean, you either own it or you don't own it. And, you know, you own it. And your cabinet shuffle suggests that you know you own it. So stop all that. All the efforts to date have been so technocratic, right? All through CMHC, you know, an emphasis, and I would say two big important things. One, they're all very technocratic. So you've got these kind of indirect, ineffective, but expensive programs that nevertheless do not yield results and certainly don't yield results that people see. And people who are smart on policy would go, yeah, but Jesus Christ, man, like it's not, you know, there isn't just a wand you can, okay, fine. Nevertheless, indirect, expensive, ineffective. That's the net total of what all this talk about housing through CMHC and other instruments have been. The second thing is that it really, from my perspective, runs the risk of really making the government look like it's checked out, right? Because it is afraid. It is afraid of this issue, and it acts like it's afraid of this issue. And I think it's got to run toward it. I think it's got to come up with creative policy solutions that are activist and that are direct. And I don't know if that's some of the stuff that Polyev is talking about incentives that trickle down. I think probably, John Webster's suggestion of take on the political jeopardy by using a convening role to get all levels of government, industry, labor together, start talking about it, look like at least you're trying to build a roadmap. And I know that's process, not results, but still it's something. And I think that it probably means, you know, it also means a mind shift in not just talking about affordable housing, but housing that's affordable. And I think this is a big challenge, is that when people hear affordable housing, they think it's tenement housing, they think it's project housing, they think a bunch of things about what that's been in the past, they think it's not for them, they think the builders don't want to build it, they don't think it'll be for them, they don't want it in their neighborhood. And I know I'm going to get a slew of comments on
this. You know who doesn't want to live in subsidized housing? The middle class and those working hard to join it.
Exactly. So that's why I would flip the phrasing. Stop talking about affordable housing. Start talking about housing that's affordable and start using the almighty power of the federal buck to incentivize municipalities, the provinces if need be, and certainly the builders and the trades to do that. And maybe immigration is part of the problem. Maybe some of the stuff you say is, listen, there's going to be an additional boost if you're willing to work in the trades for an extra year or two when you first arrive and all that sort of stuff. But let's face it, a lot of those international students that are coming in here, aren't then like going, you know what, in the summer, I think I'm going to pour concrete. That's not fucking happening. It's a complicated issue.
Actually the federal government's line, right? Because the yin to Fraser's yang was Mark Miller, the new immigration minister, coming out and saying, hey, all you housing advocates, all you people that are blaming immigration for housing, we can't build houses without immigrants. So I don't know that tracks.
There's only an abstract logic to that, right? So in any event, my fundamental thing is you own this thing and you got to do something with it. And it's got to be, take a page out of your own book. Barge into provincial and municipal territory, use the power of the treasury, and dole out some incentives. But it's got to be direct stuff. All this indirect technocratic agency, if you qualify, if you have 55,000 lines of, you know, these forms and all this, like, fuck, that stuff doesn't work, and it's proven to not work.
Hey, Corey, the shit positioning of the Trudeau government on this issue actually helps Ford, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course it does. But like, it's also on point. Like, it's exactly what we were just talking about. And you hit the nail on the head, David, when you said, who doesn't think they're going to be living in affordable housing? People in the middle class and who are looking to join it. Like, that is the problem. The core voter group that's going to decide the next election do not think they're ever going to get this kind of housing. And this is exactly what I was talking about in terms of where is their NIMBYism and where does it come from? And, it comes from people who actually already own a place. That's the people who don't want to see anything else fucking built. and they don't want to have, you know, themselves inconvenienced or their property value affected in some way, even though their property value is going up massively. They are adversarial to it. That's where NIMBYism comes from. And, you know, but the voter demographics that are going to determine the next election are going to be new Canadians and millennials. Trust me on this. They are the two biggest pockets of swing voters out there in the electorate, not just in Ontario, but in places like Vancouver and the GVA as well. Like, this is where those people are. And they're not looking for a subsidized rental housing unit. They're looking to buy a place that will be theirs and to be participate in the middle class. And how you participate in the middle class in North America today is through home ownership. It's the biggest way to increase your wealth as an individual, you know, who's working for a paycheck, is to be able to get a mortgage and own a house and have it appreciate up in value and then use that to fund your retirement eventually. And what do people who are younger, people who are millennials today want? They want to have the same advantage and the same opportunity that their parents had. And, you know, the trick is going to be, you know, dealing with these two different pockets of voters, which, you know, the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party both benefit from at different levels at different times. But, you know, older voters who have property, you know, those are people who are, you know, reliable voters and have elected a lot of governments in this country. But where the swing voters are now are not that, are not those groups. It's millennials and new Canadians. And what they're looking for is sort of at odds.
So, but one of the things that's clear, since we're talking about politics here, is that this is not a problem that is going to be solved in any way that Canadians will notice it being solved in any timely electoral way, certainly not for the next federal election, not for the next provincial election in Ontario or anything like that. This is a problem that's going to be with us for a long time. Maybe we can start chipping away at it now. So politically, the trick here, presumably, Corey, is to make sure that somebody else is getting blamed for this. The problem's not going to be fixed. Nobody's going to be able to stand up and say, mission accomplished, affordable housing now exists for those seeking middle-class homes in Ontario. Rather, it's going to be a question of who do people blame at election time for the fact that there isn't. So that's why the feds need to get on their front foot and shift the onus back to somebody else, because the onus appears now to be on them. The onus needs to shift back to somebody else.
But what are federal housing programs currently? They're about building subsidized housing. And I don't think that's where the votes are. I think it's about attainable housing. If you want to look for a term that actually resonates, it's attainable housing. It's not affordable. There is no such thing as affordable housing right now in large urban areas in Canada. None of it's fucking affordable. It's attainable. It's not affordable, but it's attainable. At least you can get a mortgage to get it. And right now, I think the Trudeau government's on a double barrel blast of bad news in terms of it being less attainable because of interest rate hikes and pressure testing rules around mortgages that the federal government controls. That means, you know, even though housing costs have come down a little bit, that it's never been further away for most people who are going to try to get a mortgage. And the type of housing that they're talking about building and the programs they're trying to build aren't for the people who are going to elect them. You know, low-income renters are not a very reliable group of voters for anyone. And if they vote for anyone, it's not for the Liberals or the Conservatives. It's for the NDP. And if Jordan were here, I'm sure she would be making that point. So I'll make it on her behalf. Renters tend to vote NDP. And they do best in that category. So if the Liberal solution is to build rental housing for low means tested, low income people, you're making the problem worse for yourself, not better from a political standpoint. And I think from a policy standpoint too. But, you know, I think you're totally right. There'll be a division between people who are working to actually address the problem and willing to take on the political fight to do so and parties that are not. And I know which side the votes are in my estimation, and that's the side that you're seeing Ford go on, and I think you're going to be seeing other governments go on too.
Yeah, I think it's high time the Fed stopped talking about why they can't do more and finding a way to do more, if only to force somebody else to step up. All right, listen, one last thing we wanted to talk about this week a little bit of noise in the media this week around Poilievre's sort of continuing dialogue with conservative partisans and his own personal base out there about things like the World Economic Forum and other conspiracy theories that exist in the general public. It's interestingly at odds with the ad campaign that came out last week, which was shaved all of his edge off, didn't appear to ally him with that type of politics or that type of thinking, showing him as a very reassuring, comforting figure in the advertising. Yet in specific direct mail correspondence, he's still an angry guy railing against various conspiracy theories. I think he can get away with this till the cows come home, you guys. I don't think that anybody really know, other than the people that are crazy about the World Economic Forum, I don't think other people even know what it is or whether it's important that anybody would go to it or not or what the stakes would be in that. So I just think that, and there's no real general awareness of how you subterraneally are communicating with people. So I think that it's smart what they're doing.
Yeah.
No?
Me too. I mean, I think it's, you know, part of that milieu in the last 48 hours, you know, this point has been made over and over and over again by Polyev, but it's sharp in the last 48 hours. We see this WEF, issue, and then he follows up sort of bashing the, you know, Canadian press is the arm of the CBC state, you know, all this kind of fucking bullshit. And in many ways, I think that's really kind of the point. Like, it's almost it just reflects a fundamental observation about where media is at. And it harkens to some of your hurly-burly, that trio of podcasts you did about the state of media, which is that you wouldn't be able to get away with this 25 years ago because the national conversation was being held nationally across a handful of mechanisms, channels, platforms, and through tubes that connected people together across the country. Now it's not. And so I just think in a world where you and I learned politics and campaign strategy and communication strategy, David, the sweet spot was always when we could get all of our media working in sync. I get my paid media, my own media, my earned media synchronized with the same message, generating the same impressions. And now I just think, you know, there's no disadvantage to having a differentiated media campaign. You can use your paid media to try to target some audiences and soften your image or advance your image or move from freedom to common sense as a sensibility. And then you can continue to communicate with those captive audiences that are going to give you money, give your votes, and give you your energy. And the contradiction between the two is only going to be captured by, sadly, dwindling earned media that has fewer and fewer observers. And so, you know, it's a fucking, it's almost a sequel. It's almost in mini, the fourth podcast in your trilogy of podcasts about the state of media. And it's such a fundamental statement about where it's at and the risks and benefits that come along with it.
I think we're pretty much perfect alignment here on this one. Yeah, I don't think it matters for a lot of the reasons that Scott said. You know, it is something that almost has a double benefit in that it tweaks the nose of the establishment media, which I think is a narrative that largely helps Polyev. It doesn't hurt him. And it energizes a group of people who will actually go and pound in lawn signs and who will give you money. And I think back to earlier eras of similar things, like the amount of money in the Harper era that we raised on issues like the Canadian Wheat Board and on long gun registry. These are not mainstream issues that touch many households, yet they were the bread and butter of the direct mail fundraising program for, you know, basically 15 years. And both of those issues, you know, probably the Wheat Board probably raised $5-6 million for the party, and the Long Gun Registry probably $20 million. Like, it's, you know, but neither are issues that the general public or general electorate gives two flying fucks about, or is even aware of. They're just not even on their issue matrix at all, like at all. Yet that they energize a smaller group of people. Now, you know, what people think is happening at the World Economic Forum, like only Stephen Harper would know. He's the guy who went there the most. but you know, the interweb says it's, you know, it's an evil globalist conspiracy. Sure, whatever. You know, but from a political communications perspective, I think they're right where the pay dirt is. And I think, you know, whether you feel good about this or bad about this, I sort of have mixed feelings about it overall, because it's not just on the right. It's on every part of the political spectrum where you're seeing these kinds of things, whether it's at, the Occupy Wall Street movement that you saw, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, but you have, you know, sort of a almost a confluence of the left and the right around some of these issues, around, you know, global trade and global economics, that, you know, brings the Bernie Sanders and the Donald Trumps of the world, onto basically the same square on the playing board. However you feel about them, be damned. Like, I think, you know, if we're talking about politics and the exercising of the exercise of political campaigning, I think it's smart. I think it's where it's going. And, I think the sort of pot shots that you're seeing on a fairly regular basis from the mainstream media on this stuff, only encourage it to happen more, because they're like the times two multiplier of benefit.
Can I just add?
I don't know much about the conservative ad buy, but I'm seeing the ads.
Yeah. No. Me too. That's because we watch sports. And they're all over sports. I would just add one last thought, which is, it'll be tempting for some, and I'm looking at you, Christian Freeland, to get your back up and go, all right, let's just settle this once and for all. Okay. You know, I had dinner with 9 CEOs, right? The head of the European Bank and yes, the Crown Prince of Spain, but a lot of important work came out of that. Don't do that. Don't do that. I stopped telling my story about how I went to Davos in 1999 and wandered into a hotel lobby and ended up very drunk with Quincy Jones and Chris Tucker, which I thought was the greatest story in the world I'd ever had, until people started saying, you sound like a cock.
No kidding.
Okay? You sound like a cock. So don't take this fight. But by the way, I did get drunk with Quincy Jones and Chris Tucker. And yes, that makes me cool.
Okay. So which one of you two geniuses thought it was great to put Paul Martin next to Bono all the time? Because I thought back when we were campaigning against you, that was the fucking best thing that we could have ever asked for you guys to do, for a similar reason. It just looks so fucking elitist and detached and star fucking and all the rest.
That's exactly what we were doing.
Yeah.
That's
exactly what we were doing.
We were star fucking.
Star fucking. Yeah.
We were star fucking. But by the way, yeah, I always thought that you're. I thought you were howling.
People don't appreciate it. People don't appreciate it.
Always thought you guys howled like your dick was caught in a mousetrap. I always thought you sounded silly about it, like people weren't really actually caring.
Mr. Pinsent, how about ringing in the AUs?
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The AUs are about to begin.
I'm going to steal what I'm certain is David's AU. I'm going to steal what I'm certain is David's Hey You, but it doesn't matter if it gets said twice. My Hey You goes out to Hugh Siegel, our friend, enormously influential Canadian, as people rightly say, the happy warrior of Canadian politics for decades and decades and decades, chief of staff to Bill Davis when he was a very young man, chief of staff to Brian Mulroney, a candidate for the leadership of the Conservative Party, someone who ran for office relentlessly. I really admire the fact that he was one of the most important policy and political thinkers of our time, but he desperately also wanted to be a member of elected office. None of his time in back rooms caused him to be jaundiced like me and absolutely skeptical of the value or the virtue of serving in elected office. He thrived and thirsted after it for years and years and years. It's a shame that he never succeeded. He passed away last week. He was just a lovely, generous, generous person. And we are the weaker for not having him.
Thanks for doing that, Scott. Really nice. Corey?
Well, as I was joking with you earlier, between Robbie Robertson and Hugh Siegel, I'm wondering if, as a former two-time guest of the Hurley Burley, if I should be taking a life insurance right now. Given the way your guests are dropping like flies, I don't know. Well, I was going to building on the theme of housing of our show, do my Hey You to Sean Fraser. I think that if he wants to have a political future, it's going to be incumbent on him to actually break probably a bit with the center, with the PMO, and actually chart a course where he's getting shit done. And, you know, what's the old bumper sticker in the South? Jesus is coming, look busy. You know, you better look busy on this file. You better fucking look busy. And, you know, we'll see where he goes with it. But, you know, there's a big opportunity, but there's also an opportunity to demonstrate that you don't have the royal jelly. You know, so my hey you is, hey, Sean Fraser, it's time to step up.
Yeah. It is. All right. And I'm my hey you. I'm going to, first of all, as Scott predicted, second Scott's comments about Hugh Siegel. I greatly admired him as an intellectual and greatly enjoyed him as a friend. I got the opportunity through mutual friends to end up spending a lot of social time with Hugh. And boy, he was funny and fun and smart and witty always to be around. And, you know, he'd always make the point. He had such a great way of making his partisan point in a way that you couldn't be angry about it. You could only smile at the fact that he'd stung you the way he'd stung you. And I do want to note the passing of Robbie Robertson, who an early friend of the pod. It's impossible to gauge how much confidence and momentum having Robbie come on the podcast at that point of our little venture here at Air Quotes meant to all of us. And he's so generous with his time and so open with the conversation, and said some things to me I'll never forget. I'll just never forget him telling me that his mom said to him, be proud of being an Indian, but be careful who you tell. I just think that's such an amazing way to go through life, thinking about that way. Anyway, Hugh and Robbie, both for different reasons, greatly enriched my life and the lives of many, many other people. Thank you for gracing the hurly-burly, and in Hugh's case, thanks for being my friend. All right, everybody, that's the show for today. We'll be back next week, hopefully with a full complement, and certainly into September, these people are going to be taking their responsibilities much more seriously, and the four of us will be here regularly. I'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, our sponsor, CN Rail, all of you who watched or listened, thanks so much, and we'll see you next week with more Cursed Politics. Until then, take care of yourselves.